Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.
Hello and welcome. Sit down, make yourself comfortable, take your shoes off, unless you're driving, and enjoy. We are so glad to have you on board. It is the Pitch Talks podcast. We are back here in the 2022 season. My name is Andrew Zuber. It's your boy, the Zoobs. I am joined by my co-host from North Star Bets. It's Nick Ashburn. Nick, how are you? How excited are you to be back here on the airwaves with the Pitch Talks podcast?
I'm really excited. I mean, this is a brand that means a lot to me. I've been a part of Pitch Talks before on those stages, but I've also visited ones that I was not a part of. And I think that, you know, this brand represents kind of loose, free-flowing baseball talk, fun, you know, beverages, maybe less so in the context of the podcast, but you never know. And we're going to have some really interesting guests here. Our first guest is Eno Saris. And between you and I, you know, we've done a lot of work together previously at Yahoo Sports. I think people see Zoobs and they see someone who's a very funny type of person on social media. And they see me as someone who is sort of dead-eyed and joyless and cold and analytical. And I think both of us are a little bit more like the other than people realize. And I think we'll bring it together for an interesting total package.
I can bring the dead-eyed sarcasm as deeply as needed. No, I agree totally. I'm really looking forward to this. I think, as you said, we've sat beside each other for holes. We sat beside each other for the 2018 Blue Jays, so that should count.
That's the worst one. I think that's literally the worst season in recent memory. 2013 has a bit of a claim on it potentially, but
yeah, absolutely true. But yeah, it's really exciting. I echo everything you say there about the Pitch Talks franchise. Super honored to be tasked to be carrying this flag forward with this podcast. Really excited with sort of the type of guests we're able to get into. Really, I think towing that line between, you know, digging a little deeper into what some of the numbers you're seeing mean and what it may mean going forward, and also keeping it lighter, enjoying the frivolities of a long season and the things that keep you from going crazy watching that many hours of baseball, as well as you said, bringing each other towards the middle, bringing a little bit more of the hardcore baseball from inside my mind and a little bit more of the complete absurdities from inside your head. It's going to be a baseball MLB-wide focus podcast, obviously being two guys in Ontario, two folks who have extensively covered the Blue Jays. We're going to get into a lot of Blue Jays talk. I think that is something that people are going to want to hear. We're going to want to explore. So there is lots to get into. It also helps, of course, the Blue Jays are a relevant team to talk about, and things are happening with them winning and changing their manager and being in the hunt for playoff race and now approaching the trade deadline, being somebody that is expected to be an active buyer. We will start with the beginning of the John Schneider era, 8-2 under John Schneider as the manager, run differential of plus 46. It certainly helps when you get 23 of those in one game, when you get half of your run differential in a game where you score 27 times. Nick, obviously, it can be difficult to ascertain what exactly impact the manager is having on a game. In 10 games, we know from a huge sample size of a baseball season, there's not a lot to extrapolate in the big picture of things. But what have you seen under the new manager that either gives you pause, gives you excitement, is an identifiable difference? Sort of how do things feel in the new era for you so far?
Yeah, it's interesting. You don't want to come to too firm a conclusion. Like you said, it's only 10 games. And look at the opponents, you know, the Blue Jays have played a Royals team that is kind of decimated by lack of vaccinations, sort of self-inflicted wound there. You've got the Boston Red Sox, who seem to be kind of completely falling apart. So there's been some other factors that played into how well they played. But, you know, the plus 46 run differential, only half of that is from one game. If you had a 9-game stretcher who went 7-2 with plus 23, that'd be really nice as well. So even if you throw that game out, they've been very strong in the early going under Schneider. You know, there aren't that many big moves to point to. You could point to the lineup shuffle. I really like them getting Vladdy up to 2. It's something he's been kind of resistant to in the past. And, you know, I think in 2022, the wisdom is you want your best hitter hitting second. The Blue Jays had a lot of success with that with Donaldson in the past. And, you know, this is the time to do it, right? Like, you've changed managers. It's easy to say to Vladdy, you're our best hitter. This is where we need you, and something needs to change, because, you know, the team had been playing poorly enough that a manager was fired. So it's a good time to do that. I don't know if I'm sold on Bichette as a cleanup man. I just think that overall, you know, Teoscar Hernandez is a better hitter. I understand why Bichette, he puts the ball in play a lot, but, you know, he's actually struck out more this year. So the difference between the two in that isn't as significant as it would normally be. And then you had a, you know, Jordan Romano four out outing on Saturday. You didn't get a lot of that under Montoyo, but, you know, I don't know, Zoobs, if there's anything you see. I don't see a profound difference. Like, the Blue Jays are playing a new brand of baseball. I think that would be an overstatement.
Yeah, you could point at some micro things. There's been some hit and runs at the bottom of the lineup there. You know, when Espinal is up there, sort of trusting him to put the ball in play and putting Matt Chapman in motion in front of him. And I guess, as you said, you know, moving Vladdy up to two, I land fairly agnostic when it comes to lineup. You know, maybe over the course of a season, you one or two runs difference in the micro, it's, you know, we're talking about fractions of run difference having Vladdy hit second or third. But ultimately, as you said, this is the opportunity here when you are making a change to implement some of your style and sort of say, you know, your preferences sort of aren't more important than what is best for the team. And that's something that I think, you know, when we talked about the minor rumblings of things that people were dissatisfied with on Montoyo, it did seem to be a little bit of, you know, the rumblings where the players were looking for a little bit more of him to be a manager, to be somebody that had, I don't want to say convictions, but would even say, you know, your comfort comes behind what is best for the team. I've sort of land on best spot for Vladdy in the lineup is wherever he hits best, is sort of like, you know, I mean, the most valuable thing he can do is hit a bunch. And that means he's hitting a bunch, hitting fourth or third or second, so be it. But as you said, the numbers do say he should be hitting second. And I don't think there's any real way to argue that. Something that, you know, when we look at player deployment, the catching situation, obviously at this point, you're going to want to have Alejandro Kirk in the lineup every single day, whether that's how he matches up with your pitchers behind the plate versus DHing, and, you know, always having to keep in mind of George Springer's need to go through the DH slot, of Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s need to go through the DH slot. I know that, you know, a month ago when the offense was struggling and they hadn't made the move with Montoyo yet, there was quite a bit of fervor to upgrade the bench, left-handed bats. You sort of take your pick. But if you look at this now, if you're sorting through WRC plus, you have to get 11 players deep to get to Santiago Espinal, to get to somebody who is basically a below average hitter. Does that sort of change your focus in terms of what you think the team should be prioritizing going into the deadline? Basically, are you believing that Raimel Tapia and Kevin Biggio is enough in that bench for left-handed options to say we don't need to make a I don't want to say drastic, we don't need to trade for a guy that's going to look for a lot of playing time? It's easy to say, you know, they should upgrade the Zimmer slot, but Zimmer barely plays. He's speed and defense. That has utility. If you're going to upgrade that, are you going to have to get a guy that needs to play more when, again, they've had some established hitting? Do you think that that need is diminished, or would you be still looking to sort of add to that bench rotation?
I think I'd still be looking at it. You know, Tapia is a guy that's a little bit tougher to trust over the long term, although he's improved his contact quality this year. He's done some interesting things. You know, Biggio, I've tended to be more of a believer than some other people. There's a lot of reason for skepticism with him because his profile is so bizarre. But yeah, those other two spots, like the Zach Collins emergency catcher who doesn't do anything spot, that's wild how little he plays. Like, he's getting a couple of plate appearances a month. I think it was 3 plate appearances between June 25th and July 25th. Like, you just can't have that. Have a position player be the emergency catcher. Like, that's what every other team does. I understand how Kirk is a little bit different, but there are spots on the bench where you could have a little bit more, you know, of a corner bat, maybe not even necessarily left-handed. Like, there's just, they are playing essentially with, you know, kind of a bench that's 2 people deep. And because the lineup is so good, it works. But if they were to get a couple of injuries, I think that lack of depth at the back of the bench would really come to the fore. So I would look to add position player 2 at the deadline. I know that pitching is where the spotlight is. No one trusts Kikuchi in the 5th spot. You know, the bullpen could definitely use a piece or two, but I would not ignore the need for potentially another guy, because all it takes would be a couple of injuries. And I know the catching is super deep, but basically any other position is not particularly deep.
And somebody else could take over Zach Collins' job of tweeting out a W after they win. That's not a,
yeah,
not a huge lift.
Quite a few Blue Jays have Twitter accounts, and it's a 1 character, you know, and you don't win every game, so it's not much of a lift.
It's not too heavy. I think they can assign that to somebody. You touched on the pitching a little bit, and we're going to talk to Eno Saris, as you said, in a moment here, a pitching guru, a guy that really understands what is working and sort of identifying what is standing out as both needs and pluses and minuses. Are there any names? You mentioned, obviously, swing and miss in the bullpen. I think the top part of the rotation is pretty set, but you mentioned that Kikuchi slot. Where are you looking in terms of top of the market, middle market, bargain bin? How do you think this deadline is going to be approached? We've seen, I think, this team in contention here for a couple years. There was the Robbie Ray, Taiwan Walker additions 2 years ago when they were in that Abridged 2020 season. It was Barrios last year in 2021. Do you see them sort of shopping a little bit more like 2020, where they're trying to grab upside, or emptying the coffers again for a Barrios? We're going to make a guy an extension offer after this sort of deal.
I'd be surprised if it was the huge offer, to be perfectly honest. I think they see the back of the rotation as the issue, not the front of the rotation. So you've seen them in the past. They went and got Liriano to lock down that fifth spot, even though they didn't think he was a big part of, you know, playoff rotation. You know, Robbie Ray and Taiwan Walker are guys that were, they thought of as back rotation guys at the time. Obviously, we know what happened with Ray. And even Walker's career has kind of taken off since then. So you don't know with that upside, but I think that's more, I would really be interested in a high level reliever. And that's something they've never done. They've always shopped at the very most in the middle of the market with relievers. They've always tried to find value. They've gone, you know, the Joaquin Benoit route in the past, where they get someone who is in theory good, but having a rough year. They think they can turn them around. I'd like them to see them just like nail someone who is good and is performing well. A good example would be Daniel Bard, of a guy with the Rockies who's just, you know, he throws really hard. All the statistical underlying numbers are solid. That's the type of guy that they should maybe go and get for the first time, because the bullpen has some good talent undoubtedly, but it's pretty short, and they could use someone, you know, Jimmy Garcia as your eighth inning guy in the playoffs is not super encouraging.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. I think they've definitely shown the penchant to address needs each of the last couple of years, even when maybe they weren't already ready to be a contender. They went out and they got some of the more mid-level, as you mentioned, sort of reliever guys last year, and grabbing Richards and grabbing Simber and sort of making those necessary upgrades. And again, the year before that, sort of addressing the rotation. I expect it to be addressed, and I expect it to be some pretty exciting moves. And speaking of sort of picking out those free agents and especially not free agents, picking out those trade deadline acquisition targets and picking out some pitchers that maybe have room to improve and room to grow. There are a few minds I would rather talk to sort through those numbers and to explain to us the who's and the what's and the why's than Eno Saris of The Athletic. He is going to join us now. What a pleasure it is to welcome our first guest, the first guest in the Pitch Talks podcast. One of the elite minds in the baseball sphere online. You know him in his work from The Athletic MLB. The Slinger of Stuff Plus is the sort of the beautifully put moniker, the master of trademarks coming in with The Slinger of Stuff Plus. Somebody that really doing an excellent job, I think, of explaining what you're seeing when it comes to pitching or hitting, and really breaking it down in a way that we can quantify, because it really can be tricky to quantify pitching and what makes good stuff, what makes effective pitchers. I know that's a sore spot for me sometimes, so I'm thrilled to get the chance to welcome our very first guest here on the Pitch Talks podcast, Eno Saris from The Athletic. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I remember going to the Pitch Talks in Toronto very fondly, the in-person version, and so I'm honored to be your first guest.
Maybe one or two less beverages on the podcast this time than in the famous Pitch Talks live events, to start with, at least. We'll start off.
We can ramp up.
Yeah, we'll call it a very dry run. We will ramp up. You know, obviously, we are here. It is late July. We are approaching the trade deadline, is within a week. We've already seen the first name off the board, Andrew Benintendi, the name that everybody is asking about, of course, and making all the headlines. Juan Soto, sort of a two-part question here is, if you had to prognosticate, obviously it's a big question, is where you think he is going and where you think he best fits and where you think maybe it's best for baseball that he lands up. Where are sort of your inklings early on as to what this is going to turn out to be?
Best for baseball is an interesting one. I'll start in a different direction, though. I do think I had an article up today that said that Andrew Benintendi was one of the top five projected on base percentages that was available at the trade deadline. And that's, you know, that's one thing that Juan Soto does really well. He's also left-handed outfielder. So I kind of actually think that this does have some meaning for the Yankees, that maybe they're not really that deep into the Juan Soto sweepstakes, as it were. And maybe they just, maybe it's a question of the luxury tax, or maybe it's a question of wanting to hold on to Anthony Volpe, their shortstop prospect. You know, when they got Isander kind of for left for shortstop, it seemed like a stopgap situation. They did not go after one of the big free agents. Maybe they really believe in Volpe. They don't want to give him up. Whatever the reason is, they have a lefty that can get on base now. Maybe they're out on Soto. Not saying that Benintendi's the same as Soto, but, like, you know, it does mean, you know, they'd have to do more machinations with their major league roster. They'd have to maybe release Joey Gallo if they were going to go get Soto. So I think that the Yankees are a little bit less likely today to get him. I think the most likely are sort of the Padres and Dodgers and Cardinals. They are the teams that have this, the prospect depth that it takes to go get Soto. And I'm going to put the Padres as the most likely destination for me, because AJ Preller likes to take the big swing. He loves to go get players that he once tried to sign or did sign with a different organization. He's brought together Nomar Mazara and Jerickson Profar and Jorge Alfaro, all guys that he signed when he was with the Rangers. And he had a chance at Juan Soto and didn't get him. And then lastly, they're going to offer Robert Hassel III, who's a center fielder, CJ Abrams, who's a shortstop, and they can maybe even throw in Luis Campusano as a catcher. That's three up the middle prospects. That's something I don't think any other team can really match. And the last question you said, what's best for baseball? You know, like, for baseball business, for like ratings, it would probably be like the Yankees or Mets or Dodgers. But for baseball viewers, I like new blood. I would rather he went to a team that hasn't won it, that isn't a perennial contender. So I kind of like the Padres for that, you know?
Thank you for not taking the Blue Jays bait there. Just very easy to just say, bring up to the Blue Jays and have us nod and be like, this guy's smart. He knows
what he's doing. Wow, he's got it. I'm glad we had him on.
The Blue Jays like to keep their prospects, right? I mean, they did give up some for Matt Chapman, but I think this would require for the Blue Jays major leaguers. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd have to give up people off their major league roster, and I don't know, they kind of have a pretty good major league squad.
Yeah, I think it's fair to assume the Blue Jays are not at the top of the list, as much as many of our listeners would like to hear that. As a positive for them, for the Blue Jays fans who are listening, you know, Yankees being out, I think, is something that people like to hear. You know, also for future reference on this podcast, when we say what's best for baseball, we're not necessarily saying what's good for owners' pockets, generally. that's not really our vibe, but you never know.
Are you actually saying what's best for the Toronto Blue Jays?
Nah. People admit more than that. What's best for the fans, the baseball fans in general. You know, one piece that you did recently I thought was interesting was about kind of the second tier of players available at the deadline, because fans are so fixated on those very top guys like the Soto, like Luis Castillo, and you were doing a good job of sort of rooting through the guys who are on the next level. And Benintendi was actually one of those guys. But, you know, there's also people like David Peralta, Daniel Bard, Anthony Santander. What are some of those guys who are maybe not making the most headlines that really interest you over the next couple of days?
Yeah, David Peralta, I think, is super interesting. He's a Gold Glove outfielder. He's got an interesting story. He used to be a pitcher, and this is his second iteration. And then, you know, there's a stat called barrels, and barrels are just quantify how hard, like, if you're good at hitting the ball hard and in the air. And they're actually a super powerful stat because they're more predictive of future power than any other single stat. And so Peralta is, I think, maybe the second best barreler or third best barreler available at the deadline. So you got a lefty who can play defense in the outfield and barrels the ball really well. He's not a liability when it comes to strikeout rate. He can get on base with a walk too. And then the Diamondbacks have maybe the best prospect in baseball right now. Corbin Carroll, he's in the outfield. They have Alec Thomas in the outfield. You know, it's time for Peralta to go play for a contender. And I think a lot of teams could use him.
The way the game shifts, the way the baseball sort of trends, you know, velocity and relief pitching usage and sort of the way that shifting, all those sort of things, the way that the game has modernized in the last little bit. Are there any trends in baseball that you're seeing right now that particularly interest you that you think could have an impact on how teams are built in the next little bit, how teams approach the deadline and or even player acquisition or player deployment in the next little bit? Is there sort of some wider scoping trends that you've observed that you think maybe are indicative as to what we are going to see in the next little bit of the game?
I think there's this interesting thing going on. There's a new slider that is all the rage, and it's called the sweeper, and it's a very horizontal slider that you know, very sort of east-west type slider. And I think it's interesting because the game had become so north-south. You know, we've been talking about fastballs that jump, that have ride, and then you sort of have your breaking ball fall off of that. And when the game becomes super north-south, what the hitters have started to do, and you started to see this, and, you know, Marcus Semien, in fact, you know, said that this exact thing. He said, well, you know, normally you want to target the bottom of the ball because you want to launch it. You know, you want to hit it in the air. When you face somebody with ride, when you face somebody with a four seam that's at the top of the zone like that, you actually have to sort of train yourself to try and hit the top of the ball, because then you'll hit it flush, because that ball sort of jumps up into your bat, basically. So there are more and more hitters now that are training. The Astros are all full of high ball hitters. And you know, you have this sort of Semien approach. There's more and more hitters now that are training for the high fastball, that know what to do with the high fastball and have sort of a north-south approach. You look at the high fastball, the low breaking ball doesn't look that good anymore. So, you know, you can kind of just focus on high balls and you've got a plan. Well, what happens if you've got a super east-west sweeper that kind of just, that's all on a different plane? Then it's kind of hard to factor that into your approach as a hitter. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things where there's, you know, hitting and pitching is, it's like a whole cat and mouse game. And so, you know, if the sweeper becomes the thing that everybody does and everyone's doing the sweeper, then all the hitters are going to have a plan for what to do with the sweeper. And then you might have to move on to the next pitch. So I just think that's fascinating, where like something becomes popular. And then also another thing that happens is, when the four-seam fastball with ride became popular, there were people that were throwing four-seamers that didn't have ride, because that was the thing to do. And those guys got hit hard for homers because they didn't exactly have the A-plus version of that pitch. What we were seeing with Taylor Rogers down in San Diego is he added a sweeper, but he lost two ticks of velo to do it. His pitch got worse because of it, and now he's being hit very hard. So that's another thing that happens with trends, is something becomes trendy and people that aren't actually super suited for that start doing it. So I think that's just an interesting pitch. The sort of innovators of the sweeper probably are the Yankees, Dodgers, and Astros. But I would consider Berrios's curve one of the preeminent sweepers in the game. So, and he didn't change to that. That's just something he's had forever.
On sort of the topic of those pitch repertoire changes, and that's been a speciality of yours for a long time, is looking in deep to pitch repertoires. You know, Zubes kind of introed you as the slinger of stuff. Plus, if you read Eno's work, that's going to come up a lot, is sort of a quantitative evaluation of the pitches that people throw. And I was hoping you could kind of give our listeners a little bit of a rundown of what Stuff Plus is, you know, how you use it to evaluate pitchers, and maybe some guys at the deadline who have the interesting Stuff Plus numbers.
Yeah. So, you know, when we started out tracking pitches, we had velocity first, and velocity is, I think, the easiest way into nasty stuff. The first thing that we notice, a guy throws 100, a guy throws 98. That's easy. We've got that. Now, then we realize, some of the guys who throw 90 are still getting it done. And there are some pitches, some fastballs that are just hard to square up no matter what the velo reading says. So you know, Stuff Plus is an attempt to just look at the physical characteristics of the pitches and sum up velocity, movement, spin, angle, release point, because release point matters too. Josh Hader, part of why he's so excellent is because he has that low sideways release point and yet releases the ball kind of with his hand up so that he kind of has like an over the top movement pattern, but he has it from this crazy arm slot out there. So if you put all those things together, you get a Stuff Plus number, you know, and what's nice about it is you can capture little changes. For example, Ross Stripling, I was just talking to him when I when they were in town. He just changed in this offseason. He changed his grip on his changeup, I think to like a two seam changeup grip, but whatever it was, he changed the grip on the changeup, and his Stuff Plus is one of the biggest risers in the game year over year. And that's important because he's always had great command. He has a large variety of pitches. To have one pitch that's a legitimate out pitch is really important for him because he can, you know, he has these other pitches he can command. So, you know, Stuff Plus is part of a suite of stats where Location Plus is just looks at how good they are at locating stuff, you know, and that's where Stripling's biggest strength is. But still, to have a better out pitch this year, that's something that Stuff Plus captured.
To drill in a little bit on some specifics, to laser in a little bit on some Blue Jays specific, to be exact, you did mention Jose Berríos there when you were talking about, you know, the sweeper and sort of that trend of that east to west movement, or west to east, depending on the handedness of the pitcher, sort of that sideways movement versus north-south. The Blue Jays, as they approach the deadline, there's been a lot made, you know, the offense that basically you can go 11 deep with above average hitters, but the pitching is something that, whether it be a depth or whether it be a top line add, something the team is probably going to address. With Berríos specifically, I think if you were to ask most Jays fans, they'd be pretty comfortable with Alek Manoah in a big spot. He seems to relish that. Kevin Gausman, his two elite pitches, sort of comes and goes with those, but has shown over a large sample to be a guy that you're pretty comfortable putting into a playoff game. Berríos is somebody that I think it can be hard to match up the numbers that you've seen historically with how he's pitching right now this year with, you know, he's had a lot of quality starts. He's also had a lot of blow-up starts. Are you landing optimistic, pessimistic on Berríos? Where do you sort of think he lands this year? And is it something that you, over the bigger picture, you expect him to, you know, have that positive regression back to being a guy that you can rely on in a playoff game? Or is it a bigger concern that you can see?
I love his breaking ball. You know, the Stuff Plus model does like him overall, and mostly because that breaking ball is so good. But there is something going on with his fastball mix. I think he's not a natural four-seam guy. I think he's probably a natural sinker guy. And so sometimes the four-seam comes and goes. And I think if you've seen his starts recently, he's trying to throw the four-seam more, and it's getting hit pretty hard. So I don't know if he needs to simplify and just become a sinker curve guy, or what it needs to be if the command is what's missing. At this point in the season, some of the results become more important than stuff. Stuff is actually most powerful early in the season in smaller samples. So, you know, about 70 to 80 innings into a season, it matters more if you're striking guys out and not walking guys. You know, that's actually the sort of key predictive stat. Then again, he's okay there, but he's lost some strikeout rate from where he's been in the past. And so there is some concern there. I think you have him as a third starter in a playoff situation. I think the good news for the Blue Jays is that Manoah, Gausman can bang with anyone. 1-2, and because I have Gausman by pitching plus, that's sort of looking at locations and stuff and putting them together. At one point, Gausman was number one in baseball, and so I think you have those two guys. You feel good. Berríos you have in the third spot. That means at the deadline, I'd rather replace somebody, you know, like in the fifth spot, Kikuchi, you know, or whatever, whoever's pitching in the fifth spot. I'd rather work on acquiring that kind of pitcher. And the good news is they won't cost as much as a Luis Castillo or who is the other option? that's number one. It's just escaping my mind right now.
Frankie Montas, maybe?
Yeah, Montas, yeah. So, you know, as much as I like getting those guys, and maybe you know, they've made deals in the past, the Blue Jays and the A's, if they can get Montas at a decent deal, then I would do it, because then you really have a legitimate three, and then Berrios, you know, can be either a fourth starter or a guy who comes in and does long in the playoffs. I don't think you need to pay the full price for the two big aces. I think you can go get somebody like a rental, like a Noah Syndergaard. Hey, bring him back to Toronto, and focus more on getting to the playoffs with that acquisition. And then, you know, a sort of Syndergaard Berrios, you know, pray for rain when it comes to the third and fourth spots. I mean, it's not like everybody else loves their fourth starter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like from that you're pretty bullish on Gausman, but I did want to circle back on him a little bit, because he has been a bit of a statistically perplexing guy. Like, he has that incredible FIP, like you were talking about, strikeouts and walks are incredibly predictive. He's very good at striking guys out. He's very good at not walking guys. He also doesn't give up a ton of home runs, but at the same time, you know, if you looked at his xERA and his ERA, he gives up a fair amount of hits. It seems like the contact he gives up is not great. Like, where are you landing on what Gausman is right now? Because you could interpret him as being, like you said, one of the very best pitchers in the game, or you could knock him a little bit for some of that contact and the runs that have come with it.
I think that the key problem for Gausman is he's at his heart a two-pitch pitcher, and I say problem because you know, I say that sort of lightly, because the two pitches are amazing. You know, like the four-seam fastball and the split figure that he have are both really, really excellent pitches that he can command amazingly. For split finger, it's one of the few pitches, few split fingers out there that the pitcher can command. And he's been throwing a slider more this year. It's a suboptimal pitch. It's a below average pitch, but that's been important. I think that's why I think his home run rate is down, because people are going to keyhole him and decide, I'm looking for just this pitch. I'm looking dead red at the top of the zone, and everything that falls off of that, I won't have anything to do with. That's why he's developed this ability to throw the split finger where it looks like the four seam at the top of the zone, then drops into the zone. Generally, the only problem I have with Kevin Gausman is that he's more of a two-pitch pitcher, and the slider has been kind of a weapon for him, even if it's a below-average pitch. So I believe in him. I, you know, one of those things, like batting average allowed by a pitcher is one of the least predictive stats. It's one of the noisiest stats. And to see that he's almost allowed a 400 batting average on balls in play, I would say that is going to regress positively. Nobody's come up with a good way to say that. But that's going to go in the right direction going forward.
You know, we appreciate always your time and your ability to really dive deep into the nitty gritties of what makes things work and not work. And before we let you go, just something, because Nick and I are also fans of the frivolities, the novelties of the game. Take a trip back quickly in time. Can you tell us a little bit about the story? Nothing better at a ball game than an ice cold beverage. A little bit of the story of beer graphs and the origin and progression of the statistics on ice cold brew.
You know, before I do that, real quick, did you know that beer and baseball, like there's a history between beer and baseball that's like actually structural and important. Like the first time beer was ever sold publicly, you know, in plastic, was at a ball game. The reason that the AL and the NL split was because the AL wanted to sell beer
and DH. I mean, that's clearly a better league. There's no two ways about it.
I mean, I could write maybe I'll write a book about this someday, but beer and baseball have always been intertwined. So when we had Fangraphs, which, you know, has these great sortable leaderboards and all this great information, you know, I had this idea, what if we had spinoffs? What if we had sandwich graphs? What if we had beer graphs? And at first that seemed like just a pie in the sky idea, but then I realized there was a data source. Untappd is the social media app where people can check into their beers. And so you start getting ratings from those. You get locations, you get beer styles. And so we got all this information, and there was an API like that we could pull the data from Untappd. And so Beer Graphs was born, and we had sortable leaderboards. We had a Stuff Plus of our own. It was called Style Plus, and that was a beer's rating only within its style, which we thought was important because if you look at beer rating sites, if you look at rankings, it's almost always double IPAs and dub big stouts because those are the most popular styles. We wanted to be able to say what's the best saison, and maybe if we adjust for style, one of the saisons can jump into the top 100 or the top 20. I have a love affair with this beer called Saison DuPont that's fairly available if you're looking for something new to try. I think you might be able to catch it. In any case, we had Style Plus, and then we had Beers Above Replacement,
of course.
Bar, and we all made it sortable, and the dream was that one day if you you could put in some of your rankings, or you could put in some preference situation, and then you could, if you're on the road and you're like, I'm in Phoenix and I like these types of beers, you could actually do a sortable, filterable leaderboard that was like, here are the best beers in Phoenix according to your the things that you like. And then we would have some partnerships where you might be able to click on the beer and find out where it's being served. So that was the dream, but all dreams die in the end. What happened was they turned off the API. We didn't have the data anymore, and that was sad. But it was fun while it lasted.
Do you have a parting Ontario beer recommendation for our listeners?
I haven't been in a while. In fact, I think the last time I was there was for a Pitch Talks. I really liked, was it Bellwoods?
Yeah, that's a good brewery. Yep.
I really liked that. And I had a beer by Bench, but I don't know if they're still around.
Yeah, they're still going.
Those are my two favorite beers while there. Oh my goodness.
Look at that. Get the shirt on.
they're in Hamilton.
I think so. I think you're right.
Yeah. These guys are good. Collective Arts is
made some great.
Stranger Than Fiction is a good one.
I did not do that on purpose, by the way. I have mostly beer shirts in my. That's why I mostly wear beer shirts, and it happened to be this one today.
We appreciate it. You know, if there was a sortable leaderboard for Podgrass, we know that you would be number one on our list. We appreciate your time and your insights. Thank you so much for being a guest today on the Pitch Talks podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Eno.
All right. Lots of great information there. I feel pretty good about Jose Barrios coming out of that. I think the matches the eye of the four-seam fastball sort of getting away from him, and the sweeper being, I'll say it, trend-setting, Nick.
I don't know if it's trend-setting, if he's been doing it since like 2016, but he embodies an existing trend. That's really pedantic, by the way. That was unnecessarily pedantic.
That's what we're drawing out of each other here. The deep pedantic nature. Speaking of trends, speaking of sort of predictive nature, you've been doing some great work on North Star Bets, grabbing those daily Blue Jays picks, a great place to sort of find information, find your writing, that analytical bent, that way to identify trends and way to look at sort of where the team has been going and where they are headed, and applying that to your North Star Bets wagers. We are going to open things up and check out the run line and examine how we've been doing with some of the wagers, and take a look at the futures as well. Do you want to take us through sort of what you've been, what you had in the hopper the last couple of days?
Sure. So it's interesting because I spend a lot of my days looking into, player props, run lines, money lines, whatever. I'm digging into it and I'm writing picks pieces, consistently. So then as a result, I've done all this research. It would seem foolish not to use it myself. And so last night, for instance, I went with my first two, my top bets of the day on both of the pieces I wrote. And I was, I was very successful on one. Vladdy over 1.5 bases at -107. I love that because, In my mind, Adam Wainwright was a little bit overrated coming into the game. I felt like, you know, his expected ERA was way bigger than his ERA. I thought he was a little bit of a product of Busch Stadium being a very good pitcher's park. Like, he'd had a ton of success there, but not been good elsewhere. And, you know, his signature pitch is a curveball. So I'm like, oh, who's on the Blue Jays can drill a curveball? It's Vladdy. He's got a slugging 1,000 against it this year coming into the game. That felt like a really good pick to me. I love betting props on guys who are going to hit in the first inning, just because there's a that's not a tip. That's just like emotionally, because there's a chance you just get it over with right away. So that's a nice feeling. And Vladdy did. He got that double. So felt good about that. The flip side, obviously, you know, we're not perfect. Because I like the Blue Jays over 4.5 runs. Normally they get 5.5 runs as a line, but because Wainwright had a good ERA coming into the game, I think it pushed it down. It was -127. Felt good about it with them at Rogers Center. They, as you may recall, did not score 5 runs or particularly close to 5 runs. But the good thing about betting is it doesn't matter how much you're wrong by, you know, you just flush it away. So you can be 100% wrong or you can be barely wrong and it's the same outcome. But yeah, the Blue Jays hitting at Rogers Center against the pitcher, potentially, if you don't have faith in them at 4.5 runs, is something that I'm going to generally feel good about. And, you know, you got to tip your hat to Wainwright. He was effective against this team. But those are the type of things I like to look at when I'm betting sort of team run lines, is just, you know, is the pitcher on the mound a fraud or not? And I felt like I was putting Wainwright on fraud watch. And, you know, he proved me wrong.
Made a career out of beating the fraud allegations has been Wainwright sort of.
It's true. He hasn't thrown 90 in a minute.
Love the -107 line on the Vladdy over 1.5 bases. That's a jump on line for me as well. I wanted to talk a little bit. I'm somebody similar to you. I think I love player props. I like big numbers. I'm somebody that you might probably know this type of better if you're somebody that's in a betting group chat. When I love to see a plus sign in front of my numbers. I just, something about it. It's how I get roped in.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. -107 +107 is just a weirdly strange difference in your mind, even though there's very little kind of actual disparity.
Absolutely right. But the real big, if you want to cash in, or make a real big splash, the futures market always can be a place where you grab some large money. I want to focus a little bit. It's been a sort of a pitching heavy episode. I want to keep that going. We talked to Eno Saris again, and we plug it one more time. A great conversation, and really quickly talked about Alek Manoah is a guy that, you know, very rapidly we're really, really able to rely on. If you're a Blue Jays fan, you're pretty happy with him in any big spot. Has had sparkling numbers since he's been up. And Kevin Gausman, again, if you're the believer in pitching plus or stuff plus or location plus, for a little while was the top pitcher in the game. You think there's, you know, is it worth a sprinkle in your mind, Manoah at +1500 on the Cy Young line or Gausman +3000? I think around this time last year, you probably wouldn't have believed that Robbie Ray was going to take home the Cy Young. You probably would have been like, oh, this Gerrit Cole's to lose. Gerrit Cole does end up losing it. Can you see, I mean, Shane McClanahan, obviously, is your runaway right now, your favorite for that. Is there any enticement there for you? McClanahan's at +165. You also have Justin Verlander +265, Dylan Cease +800, and then you get into the Gerrit Cole, Shohei Ohtani, into the +1200 range. Is there any interest at all in you in those larger numbers, the +1500, the +3000 for Manoah or Gausman down the stretch here?
It's interesting because with the Cy Young, we know that pitching is an incredibly violent action that causes your arm to essentially fall off. So even the runaway winner can suddenly in the blink of an eye be gone. And I know that's equally true with position players in theory. Like, that can happen, but it's more likely to happen with pitchers. So going with sort of a dark horse guy at this point in the season, and I mean, hoping for an injury sounds grim, but, you know, seeing things potentially get derailed can be a good strategy. And it was a good strategy with Ray last year. I would probably take Gausman off my board at this point. He's had, you know, his ankle injury, and he just hasn't piled up a quantity of innings. You know, his argument is sort of based on fielding independent stats, and I don't think that those stats resonate as much with voters. Like, for instance, last year it was Nathan Eovaldi who led the AL in Fangraphs WAR, and he just didn't get a sniff in the Cy Young voting. So Gausman has an interesting case in a sense if he kept going at the rate he's been going, but the ERA is a little bit too high in this season. I don't see it. Manoah is a little bit more interesting for me because he does have the more traditional numbers that people like. Like, he does go deep into games. He'll have the sparkling ERA, the record potentially. There's a lot of guys ahead of him, though. You know, McClanahan, like you said, is really the favorite. Verlander's a, you know, sentimental guy potentially if McClanahan falls off. Dylan Cease might be sort of your late charging guy. I don't think I would sprinkle on these guys at this point. If I was going to do it, I would choose Manoah. But if you're doing that, you're doing it eyes wide open that you're sort of pulling for a guy and, you know, it's making your watching the Blue Jays Manoah starts or Gausman starts more interesting potentially. But doing it with an expectation of cashing in, I think, might be a little bit too risky.
Something to keep in mind, I think, with awards futures as well, and I feel this way, I felt this way in the NBA season as well, is you have to remember when you're dealing with media voting on awards is sometimes, you know, a story can also help. So I think Verlander at plus 265 could sort of be an interesting thing there with, like, the story of him still being at the top of his game and still being one of the best pitchers in the league and, you know, age be damned, and Houston is on top of their division. I think that's also has a lot of intrigue for me. I think there's a worthwhile on the plus 265. You see that a lot. Again, it's when it's a media award, you have to take into the whole thing. And if you wanted to, just to close off a loop on the how you could talk yourself into Manoah, the sort of the big game nature that he sort of, you could sort of say, you know, against the best teams, he's the guy that sort of tends to show up and have the big moments and swear at the dugout on the way off the field, that sort of thing. He makes the headlines when it comes to his big starts.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to be betting on how a bunch of writers feel. It is one of the weirder exercises because a lot of the betting we do is very quantitative, and it's a very specific narrow outcome. And you can say, okay, these are the trends, and this is, and you're not always going to be right by any means. But you can say, okay, well, this is exactly logic, and awards are a little bit fuzzier than that. And like you said, I think that could help a guy like Verlander have some value.
Yes, indeed. That about does it. If you're looking for more of Nick's insights on the Blue Jays or many of the other sports, you had a hot dog eating contest lines ready to go. You can find his work at northstarbets.ca. You also find the full markets on every piece of game action all season long across all kinds of sports. Tons of great stuff. A great place to play. Northstarbets.ca. That about does it for the Pitch Talks podcast. You can find Nick on Twitter at Nick Ashburn. You can find me, myself, and I at The Zoobs on Twitter. We thank you so much. You could do us a favor. Tell a friend, like, subscribe, rate, leave a review. That helps us so much with the almighty algorithm and getting some success for the show. We would really appreciate it. But if there's nothing else, until next time, we thank you so much for listening to Pitch Talks.
Thanks for tuning in.
Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.